7 FM, Eastside Radio.
And the quiz? Of course there is a quiz. Today's quiz, I would like you to please name the composer or the principal artist or the occasion, or preferably all three of those things from this small clip. Well, if you don't know by now, you won't. The occasion was the opening ceremony of the Sydney Olympic Games. The composer and the principal artist? Well, here's my next guest. James Morrison AM is a name synonymous with jazz both in Australia and around the world. With a career spanning four decades, he's carved out a unique space in the world of music, earning acclaim not only as a trumpet virtuoso, but also as a multi-instrumentalist, a composer, an educator, a conductor, and a lot of other things as well, you'll find out shortly. Born in Barowa, New South Wales, he first picked up a trumpet at the tender age of seven and has played with many jazz legends, in fact, all jazz legends. But they include Dizzy Gillespie, Dave Brubeck, Quincy Jones, Ray Charles, and Don Burrows, just to name a small few. His ridiculous music ability has seen him master not only the trumpet, but also the trombone, the tuba, the saxophone, the clarinet, the double bass, the euphonium, for heaven's sake, and naturally enough, the piano. It's simply preposterous that somebody could have so much talent, don't you think? James's contribution to the jazz world, however, goes far beyond performance. He's an advocate for music education, and he founded the James Morrison Academy of Music in Mount Gambier, where he nurtures the next generation of jazz talent. James is actually currently preparing for a concert in Sydney with Marianne Petrescu, and I'm delighted to say he joins me on the phone right now. Mr. James Morrison, welcome to Eastside Radio.
Thank you very much. Gee, after an introduction like that, what do I say?
Oh, well, you don't need to say anything. I can just play your music for the next 25 minutes. That'll be great. But, James, where is Barowa?
Actually, Barowa is how they say it. And yeah. It's out near Parkes, western New South Wales. And, a small country town. Not a lot of brass band activity out there or jazz activity. Certainly not when I was there anyway.
Well, I was going to say, how many venues were there other than your father's church?
Yes, well, the main one was just where I heard music. Dad was the Methodist minister there and Mum played the organ in church. So
yes, she played.
That was about it.
She played the organ in church. Your sister also plays trumpet and your older brother, John, is a jazz drummer.
That is correct.
That's pretty useful musical pedigree. Possibly even
it is.
It's possibly even the backbone of music in Barowa. What did you say, Barowa?
Barowa, yeah. Barowa. Well, but at that stage in Barowa, Kath, my younger sister, wasn't born yet. We'd moved to Blaney by the time she was born, and John wasn't yet playing the drums. Back in those days, the only music John and I were making was singing in the choir, which I can assure you wasn't that good. I mean, our singing. The choir was okay, but as yet, we hadn't started the jazz. When we moved to Sydney, though, I can imagine our neighbours might have a different story for you about hearing the drums and two trumpets and the saxophone and everything going.
It's what everybody dreads, isn't it? How old were you when you actually started, I was going to say your musical career, but your interest in music?
I started playing piano at the age of six and then took up the brass at seven.
And is there any truth that you stole your brother's cornet?
I stole is a very strong word. I like to say borrowed.
You borrowed it, okay. You borrowed
yeah,
it.
Yeah, yeah. No, I'd sneak under the bed when he was out and grab his cornet, take it out. He was playing in the school band and I wasn't yet old enough to be in the band, and I wanted to be, so I'd just play his cornet when he was out.
Right. And so you started the Morrison Brothers Big Band. When was that?
That was sometime later. I was 19, I think, when we started that. So that was, we wanted to have a big band. We always loved big band music. We said, well, we'll start our own.
And do you remember the first track that band performed publicly?
Gee, I'm not sure now what that would have been.
How about this? A Night in Tunisia.
Ah, that's it, yes.
Tell us a bit about your education, James, the role that school played, the role that music played, and then the role that King's Cross played.
Yes. Well, school was interesting. I learned a lot at school, but not much of what they were teaching. I had a big band I put together at school, and I used to write for it. That's how I learned to write for big band, by trial and error. So I would skip a lot of classes. That's what I mean by not what they were teaching. So I could sit somewhere and write. Mm-hmm. And unless I had a sympathetic teacher, I remember my science teacher was very sympathetic. He played trumpet. And he said, look, if you're quiet and you sit up the back and don't disrupt anyone else, you can sit and write your music, which I did. So, school, I did a lot of music, a lot of, playing in bands, writing for bands and doing things. Not much else.
How did you go in science?
Not too badly. Fortunately, most things. It was back in the days, and I'm not suggesting we should go back to this because I got away with a lot. But it was back in the days when all that matters was your score in the test.
Right.
There was no sort of what work could you do throughout the year. So I'd be writing music all year, and then the day before any exam, I just asked the teacher, "What's the exam on?" And they were always able to say, it's on these chapters of this textbook, or it's on this subject. And I'd go and read up on it the night before and then go and do quite well in the exam because it was very fresh and I just learned it the night before. And I have a pretty good memory. So I just, most jazz musicians do, because you've got to remember a lot of things when you're, playing songs from memory and everything. So I just read up about it, go and do the exam, do quite well. And everyone would go, oh, he's doing well in school. And I actually wasn't almost there at all. That was handy.
The fanfare that I played a little bit earlier on to the Sydney 2000 Olympic Games, that was acknowledged internationally as fairly stunning, and it actually set the mood for the whole of the Sydney Olympic 2000 Games. But talking about major sporting events, what is your recollection of the Davis Cup final in Australia in 2003?
Yes, well, that's different. That wasn't such a triumph. I was asked to play the Spanish national anthem, and the quick bit of background to that was there'd been a bit of a kerfuffle between Australia and Spain previously when we met them in Spain for the final.
Right.
And so fast forward a few years, and they're now in the finals with us again, and it's in Australia. And you know what Aussies are like? We said, well, because our Aussie players we didn't feel were treated so well in Spain the time before, we're not going to do the same to them. We're going to sort of get them back, in inverted commas, by treating them brilliantly, and then making sure they have the best time ever here so they're embarrassed that they ever mistreated us, sort of thing.
Yeah.
So they said that the standard thing with most international sporting events, particularly at that time, was the host national anthem would be performed live and they'd play a recording for the visiting one. They said, but no, not good enough for this one. We've got to play it live. We'll get James to play the Spanish national anthem live. And so I did. I was sent the music. Unfortunately, it was the wrong anthem. It was the revolutionary anthem, to which some of the words are, let's kill the king.
Yeah.
That was the king that was watching, by the way.
Yes. And
it's actually, at the time, was illegal to play that in Spain. And here's me playing it for their players and for their king.
And so how did somebody recover that?
Well, there was the Spanish ambassador stormed out of the stadium, and there was a lot of what's going on, and the players just stood there with their arms folded and wouldn't move, wouldn't play until they'd heard their right answer. They whisked me out of the stadium and said, you've got to get out of here. And I said, I live here. And they said, not anymore.
Not anymore, you don't.
And they found a recording of the right one fairly quickly and played it. And there was quite an inquiry afterwards, and I know John Howard was the Prime Minister at the time, sent a message to the king apologising, and so did I, and saying that it was just simply a miscommunication, that if you went, and they did this to prove it, if you go into a music store in Australia and just ask to buy a copy of the Spanish National Anthem, this is at the time, the only one you could get was the revolutionary one. So everyone just assumed that was the proper one, And, you know, no one, we didn't think. I mean, it's not like a thing in Australia. You have to be careful which anthem we play, you know.
you've travelled the world. Have you been to Spain since then? Did they let you in?
I didn't go for a little while, but I go to Spain often now. I was just there only a few weeks ago, and they love me there, and I have a great audience, and it's all good. All is forgiven.
Oh, that's
but,
good.
But I've got to tell you, after that incident, I received hundreds of emails. One of them said, one single email said, "How dare you play that anthem, you know, what an insult and everything." And all the rest said, "Viva la Revolution, we'll support you on your next thing to overthrow the king." And I said, no, I'm a trumpet player, I don't want to get involved.
That could have been your start in politics, of course.
It could have been, yes. No, I don't think that's not the way I want to be in politics.
Okay.
But
if you put that one episode aside, you have an enormous career of international recognition and of achievement. Again, putting that one aside, what's been your biggest stuff up?
Biggest stuff up other than that? Oh, gee. Oh, I know what it was, of course. How could I forget this? It was a Royal Command performance for Her Majesty the Queen, Prince Philip, the Prime Minister, the Premier of New South Wales, and 10,000 of the public. I mean, if you're going to screw up, let's make sure we do it properly in front of the Queen. I was to... it was Tommy Tico, the maestro, was conducting the orchestra.
Yep.
And I was to enter the stage to play this song by sliding down a rope. They call it abseiling.
Yes.
Slide down this rope. I had a harness on and everything connected to the rope. And I'd slide down and play my cadenza 90 feet in the air, it was at the time, and then slide down to the stage. What could possibly go wrong? Well, what went wrong is there was a knot in the rope, got jammed in the thing on my harness, and I'm stuck 90 feet in the air and can't get down. Can't go up, can't go down. I'm just hanging there in front of the Queen. They had to get a cherry picker to get me down in the middle of the performance. We had to try and make like it was part of the show.
I'm
doing acrobatics on the end of this rope. I mean, the whole thing was a farce. We got away with it.
Mm.
And I have to tell you, I would think that she wouldn't mind. But by that, I mean, when you have a conversation with a monarch, the sort of protocol, I wouldn't say it's a rule, is that that's a private conversation. You don't share it with others.
Right.
But I don't think she'd mind me saying this.
Not at this stage, anyway.
Not at this stage. She said to me afterwards, when she introduced me, they said, and Your Majesty, this is Mr. Morrison, the trumpet soloist. And she said, oh, yes. She said, that was rather wonderful. She said, I've never seen an acrobat who played trumpet so well. It was just great, yes.
You've got to...
So it was a big stuff-up, but it actually turned out okay.
Right. Well, we'll count that as a stuff-up. But you famously also presented a television show called Behind the Wheel, and that was a motoring show on Australian television. How did you get into that, and why?
Well, I've always been into cars and planes and boats and all things like that. I love all that. And... some friends of mine who are in television said, you know, you should, they'd send me on stage, they said, you should host a show. And so this was some years before the famed, you know, show Top Gear came. And we had this idea that car shows were too staid and should be much more exciting and, you know, a bit more larrikinism in your car show, which, of course, became a hallmark of Top Gear once that was.
That's right.
So we did it. We got taken off the air with Behind the Wheel for being too larrikin-y. And that is, by the way, I believe that is an adjective.
Larrikin-y, I've never heard of it. We all know what you mean.
No, I just made it up. but for being larrikins too much, we got taken off the air, and we were most indignant when about 4 years later, Top Gear came to air. We said that's what we were doing.
Yeah.
But I did end up hosting Australian Top Gear many years later. But I got onto that, and it was great fun because Behind the Wheel wasn't just cars; it meant I got to drive a Collins-class submarine. I got to fly a Black Hawk helicopter. I got to do all sorts of things. Anything that you could sort of claim had a wheel, in inverted commas, was part of the show. So it was a lot of fun.
Well, consistent with the discipline of jazz, which, if you'll pardon my understanding of it, is fairly undisciplined and full of improvisation and so on, how scripted was that show Behind the Wheel?
It was also a bit jazz, yes.
Right.
They'd say, righto, James, you're on the conning tower of a submarine now. We'll roll the cameras, you say about a script that it's got, and I'd think of something to say about what was going on. And we had a lot of fun, but it did get a little bit out of hand. I remember Kevin Bartlett was involved, and he and I took some four-wheel drives off-road, because at the time, it was just at that time, early 90s, where it was really becoming ubiquitous that every mother was driving a large four-wheel drive to drop the kids to school.
Yes.
And prior to that, if you think back to the 80s and before, four-wheel drives were for going in the bush.
Yeah, that's right.
And so we said, this is not what these cars are for. We'll show you what they're for. And we took them out into the bush. And I have to say, not one inch of the footage we shot actually made it to air. The censors got a look at it and said, this is far too radical, far too dangerous.
Wow.
People will be thinking they can do this in their cars. We can't show it. Of course, as I said, later on in Top Gear, that's the sort of stuff they showed all the time. But I have to say, we had an absolute ball. So the fact that it didn't go to air was, you know, disappointing, but it didn't mean we didn't have an absolute ball doing it.
And it's a pity you didn't patent the idea, because you would, you'd have enjoyed that.
Yeah. But you know what? I think patenting the idea that you should have fun in cars probably would have been hard to patent.
Hard to work.
It wasn't rocket science.
James, collaboration could almost be your middle name, but your collaboration with the Romanian Marian Petrescu has been described as a meeting of musical minds. In fact, you yourself are quoted as saying, I never play better than when I play with Marian. How did that partnership come about?
We met at the Newport Jazz Festival, Newport in California, and he was booked to play on the festival, had come there from I think Sweden at the time, and I was there to play with some other people. And you know, on those kind of festivals, they grab people from different bands and put them together and say, what about this, what about that, different combinations. Mm. So I ended up with this man I didn't know, and the moment I heard him play, I went, oh my goodness, what's going on here?
Mm.
Where's this guy been hiding? And later that night, we played that gig, said hello afterwards, and then nothing happened right away, but later that night I was sitting in the ballroom of this hotel, empty, you know, 3 a.m, I'm talking, playing the piano and sitting there with a young musician, showing them a couple of things. And Marian was wandering the corridors, also like me, jet-lagged and on the wrong time.
Right.
Heard the piano, came in. We sat down and he played, and we played a duo together, and we talked about music, and right away realised we were kindred spirits. I said, right, that's it. We're going to do things together.
And tell us of one such memorable occasion that you did do together.
Wow, I almost don't know where to start there, because every time you play with Marian, it's memorable.
Right.
It's special. You know those times when you hear some music, and you can enjoy music, you know, every time you hear it, but you hear something, you go, okay, no, this is special. This is like momentous. I'm glad I was here for this.
Mm.
Every time you play with him, it's like that. You go, this is special. This is something I'm always going to remember. So the chance to invite him out here to do a tour, you know, is just not to be missed.
Yeah, so what is how does the dynamic work between you and he? Who leads, who follows, or how do you even determine who leads, who follows? Or do you both lead?
You know, it's swapping all the time. It's almost like a tennis match. One person's got the ball and the other person's got the ball.
Yeah.
And it's really just whoever, you know, has an idea at the time or whatever. All you know is that his mind is operating at such a tempo, if I can put it that way, even when he's playing a ballad, just the harmonic ideas he has and everything is so on such a high level that it inspires you to lift yourself to, you know, the highest level you can too.
Yeah.
I think that's one of the great things, apart from the music itself, about playing with Marian, is after playing with him, not only are you amazed at what he did and enjoy what he did, but you get the feeling of satisfaction. You go, you know, that's probably as well as I can possibly play too.
Right, right. Here are the two of you together. Actually, we'll come back to a little bit more of the two of you in a few moments. You've got a concert coming up next week on the 16th of September at the Sydney Recital Hall in Angel Place in the city with Marian. Now, you've performed at countless venues around the world. What makes Sydney a special place for you to perform?
Well, it's home, firstly, and so that's always nice to play in your own town. But particularly this venue, of course, acoustics are always important for any musical performance.
Hmm.
And particularly with this, we just want that really crystal clear sound of the piano to come through, which you often don't get in much bigger venues. And I won't name any, but
no, I know.
But the Recital Hall at Angel Place there is just the right size. It's big enough that it's not a little club or it's not a small room, and so it has that ambiance of a hall,
right,
which is lovely to play in. But it's not so big that it in any way interferes with the sound. The acoustics there are wonderful. The piano is great. That's the other thing. With a pianist featured like this, you're at the mercy of what instrument is in the venue, or that you can get into the venue, and they have such a wonderful piano there and it's right for the room. Because just, you know, people say to me, oh, I just get a great piano. I go, yeah, no, depends on the room. Different pianos suit different rooms. And so they have a great piano for the room. The acoustics in the hall are beautiful. The sight lines are wonderful. People feel close to you, even though it holds quite a few people. And it's just a place I love to play when you want to play concert style. I mean, I love playing in little clubs and sort of intimate things too. We do a lot of that, particularly in Europe. But when you say, no, I'd like to play in a concert hall, and I've had the good fortune to play in many great halls around the world, you know, the Royal Albert Hall and all sorts of places. But the Recital Centre at Angel Place is just one of those ones I go, oh, I can't wait. This is going to be tasty.
I wonder, in its tastiness, we've discussed how jazz lends itself to improvisation. Do you have the set list defined yet? Or are you just going to get up there and do stuff? You don't?
No, not at all.
How does your quartet know how to keep up if they don't know what you're going to play?
Well, I usually introduce the song before we play it.
Oh, that's a good idea.
So,
right.
But quite seriously, I say usually, sometimes I'll just start to play and it's, you know, I'm going to start solo. And then once they hear what it is or work out what it is, they can join in. That happens too. But for a set like that with Marion, we have plenty of repertoire that we know, and so we'll draw from that. But rather than making a set list, it locks you in then to playing those tunes in that order. And sometimes you play a tune, you get all inspired, the audience feels a certain way, and you just go, oh, I feel like playing this now.
Mm.
And so having a set list, but we often write a set list. I just almost never stick to it.
We've discussed the improvisation nature of jazz, and it's quite different to the discipline of classical music. But you have an affinity with classical music as well, don't you?
Absolutely.
Beethoven's Pathétique, his Piano Concerto number 8, for example. What's the appeal of it when you consider your jazz orientation?
Look, just right off the bat, first of all, it's just a beautiful melody. It's just a gorgeous melody, and a melody you want to play. And then there's the harmonies with that melody. It's so elegant. But hear music like that, and you go, I want to play that.
Mm.
And there's no reason not to give it a jazz sensibility. People sort of may think of jazz in certain ways and go, well, it doesn't suit that. But jazz is a way of playing rather than a particular sound.
Give us a heads up. So, is it going to be played next week?
I have no idea, but now you've mentioned it, quite possibly.
There you go. I could write a set list for you.
But by all means, go right ahead. I have to warn you, with all due respect, we're as likely to stick to it as we are if I write.
I won't feel insulted if you don't. How many musical instruments do you actually own?
I don't really know. And by that I mean, over the years, you can imagine I've been doing this for many decades.
You
gather more instruments along the way. I think we're going to have to update that bio and say nearly 5 now, because I'm 62 this year and I started working professionally at 13, so that's 5 decades next year.
I didn't want to seem rude or irreverent or anything, James.
Not at all. I've collected a lot of instruments over the years and play a lot of instruments. And so, you know, specifically, I don't know how many, but I mean, I've got, you know, a wonderful tuba, a couple of euphoniums, a baritone horn, a bass trumpet or two, you know, a collection of trumpets and saxophones of all sizes and shapes. So, you know, baritone, tenor, alto, soprano. I've got a bugle, I've got a few different flugelhorns, I've even got a Chinese shung, which is a diabolical thing to try and play, but what a sound.
You don't carry them around.
Odd instruments too. No, I don't.
No.
So I carry sort of on this last gig. I just got back from a gig, Marion, and I started the tour, and we played in the Adelaide Hills at a beautiful venue over the weekend, and I had 5 with me. So that's sort of a good indication
Okay. I mentioned at the beginning the James Morrison Academy of Music in Mount Gambier. You set that up in 2015. What's that all about?
That was because I spend a lot of time on the road over many years, and when you visit places, I'd often visit universities, high schools, whatever type of school, music schools, a variety of things, and give masterclasses, they call them, or workshops. And after a while, I thought, oh, those students I've just worked with, I've sort of almost set them some homework, if you know what I mean. I'd love to come back in 2 weeks' time and see how they're going and tell them what's next. And so I thought, well, if I've got my own school, there's that element to it, to work for, over a longer period with some students. And the other one was, often when I visit a school, I go, that's great. If I had a school, I'd do that. But you also often say, no, if I had a school, I wouldn't do it. I'd do it like this. And I thought, well, I've said so many times, if I had a school, I'd do this. So perhaps I better put my money where my mouth is and have one.
Right.
So we did that in Mount Gambier as a bachelor degree. So it's tertiary level. For 7 years up till 22, and of course COVID was in full swing then, and that put the kibosh on things a bit. And since then we've sort of morphed into more of a what we call a pop-up academy, which is I take my wonderful faculty and we go and do things in different places. After 7 years of being in the one place, the one course, I felt I wanted to, typical jazz music, I guess, bust out of the cage and go, no, because we can only teach tertiary students only if they're doing a bachelor degree with this setup. I want to be able to suddenly take that wonderful faculty and those ideas and talk to primary school kids or high school kids or adults that are out of school and doing it, you know, as they call them, the weekend warriors,
right,
as well as, you know, our university students, and also in more places than just that. So we go all around the world now and do things, you know, pop up, as we say. The James Morris Academy pops up wherever.
Yeah.
So we've still a lot of roots in Mount Gambier, but we're certainly going further afield now.
I see. We've approaching the end of the program. I could talk for another couple of hours. I didn't, for example, cover the fact that you've got a bus license, you're known as a sailor, you're a mountain climber, you've got a private pilot's license, you've just been to Brazil. I was going to suggest that when you run out of activities, maybe you should learn a musical instrument, but I thought... that's not going to work. I'm playing in the background a track from A Fine Bromance, which is called My Romance. It's you and Marianne. And I'd, in closing, just like to thank you for being with us today. The concert is, in fact, next Monday, the 16th of September, and it's thanks to Live at Yours. Tickets are available now. If, in fact, there are any, I'm not sure there would be any, but you can try liveatyours.com.au or the citirecitalhall.com. James Morrison, thank you so much for joining me today on East Side Radio.
Thanks very much. Great to talk to you.
Bye now.
Bye-bye.
Seven FM, East Side Radio.